This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Stink bugs. You've seen a few. Okay, maybe more like a few thousand. It would seem that the mysterious die-off of a couple years ago is over, and the little critters are back in full force. We do know a few things for certain. The ones most problematic are officially called brown marmorated stink bugs. They emigrated from China. Their high numbers are due to not having the same natural predators here they had back home. And, oh, they are a huge threat to American agriculture. One reason the U.S. government is investing millions trying to figure out how to get rid of them. Two of the scientists leading that stink bug research are with us. We'll ask them to reveal what they've discovered so far. And if you've got a solution to offer or a question to ask, you'll be welcome to join in too, right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Stink bugs? Got thoughts about them? A question, perhaps? Or even better, a suggestion for how to get rid of them? Then we'd love to hear from you this hour at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Tracy Leskey is overseeing a number of research projects aimed at dealing with the brown marmorated invader from her base of operations at the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Agricultural Research Service Center in Kearneysville, West Virginia. Dr. Leskey, thanks so much for making time for us.
Thank you, Tom.
Also with us by phone from his lab in Blacksburg, Virginia, Virginia Tech entomologist Tom Kuhar. Dr. Kuhar, great to be speaking with you again, sir.
And great to be here.
So what do we most need to know about stink bugs? Dr. Leskey, let's start with you.
Okay. Well, you know, stink bugs are a species or a group of insects that, you know, we do have here in North America. We do have a number of species that are native to this country. But the insect that has caused the most concern recently is the brown marmorated stink bug. And this stink bug is classified as an invasive species. And what that means is that it is not native to North America. It was accidentally introduced. It is actually native to China, Japan, Korea, and Taiwan. And so this insect was accidentally introduced into the United States. And because of that, we became concerned about the potential for ecological and economic issues that it may cause. And certainly over the past few years, this is exactly what we have learned. Wouldn't you agree, Tom?
Yes, I would. And I think one of the things that we've learned, and you certainly mentioned it, we have had plenty of stink bug species in this country for over a century. And now all of a sudden everyone's talking stink bugs, and it's because we've gotten this Asian invasive species. And while it's because of the characteristics that separate this bug from the others, and that conspicuous behavior of overwintering in people's houses, that's something that no other stink bug had done before. And then the sheer numbers of bugs that you can find on the agricultural crops are far greater than any other stink bug that we have seen before.
So part of the problem is that other critters don't really much care to munch on this import from Asia, this particular kind of brown stink bug?
Well, you know, we do have native natural enemies that will attack and feed on the stink bug. There are things like assassin bugs that literally will suck the life out of these things. You know, spiders will attack them. We just had some really great photographs of bluebirds feeding on stink bugs. But, you know, part of it is that none of these predators or pathogens or parasites that we could rely on that typically keep our own native stink bug populations in check didn't evolve directly with this brown marmorated stink bug. They're still back in Asia. So, you know, that's one of the reasons. And then the second, as Tom had mentioned, the sheer numbers that we see in agriculture, this insect is not a picky eater. It has been recorded to feed on over 100 different host plants, including many of our crops. So, you know, those two factors really are the underlying principles why this insect has become such a major problem.
Dr. Tom Kuhar, are there particular agricultural crops that are most threatened at this point?
Sure. That's one thing over the last 4 or 5 years of researching this in the Mid-Atlantic, we have gotten a handle on at least the crops in our area that seem to be most at risk. And clearly tree fruit, the peaches and apples and cherries are hit hard by this bug. It is definitely a tree-loving insect. But then there's also crops such as fruiting vegetables, including peppers and tomatoes, eggplant, okra. These vegetables seem to be hit hard. And we've also noticed a preference for sweet corn on some farms that I have been on. Personally, I've seen this, where they've had a variety of vegetables, all with fruiting stages ready at the right time, and most of the bugs seem to be clustered on the sweet corn ears. And but you will see them on some of these other vegetables on occasion, but beans are another one. I forgot to mention that one. Different bean crops are attacked by the bug. We've also noticed, in addition to all of those, you've got tree fruit, you've got the vegetables. Small fruit can also be fed upon by these bugs, both grapes and your raspberries. You also have ornamental plants. We've seen where the bug can actually feed through the bark and feed on tree sap on some young trees that are developing in some nurseries. So the host plants, as Tracy mentioned, seem almost limitless, but there are definitely some plants that the bug seems to cue in on year after year, and I've mentioned pretty much those primary ones.
Dr. Tom Kuhar from the Entomology Department at Virginia Tech, you mentioned sweet corn early on there. Do I understand correctly that there's a particular problem with that crop where a consumer may not know that the corn has been affected by stink bugs until they get it home?
Yeah, that's you're hitting on a unique problem, and that is that, you know, growers or homeowners and consumers are certainly used to finding the typical insect damage on an ear of corn. You buy it at a roadside stand, and you've got that worm in the tip of it. You've got a little bit of damage. Most folks don't mind that. They chop that tip off. It doesn't bother them. Some folks it does, but it's just been a fact of life of that's what insect injury could be on a sweet corn ear. Well, the stink bug has changed the game in that it can stick its mouth parts, its stylets. It's a piercing, sucking feeder, and it could stick it right through the husk and feed on individual kernels up and down that ear. So when you have a number of bugs on that ear, could be the nymphal stages or the adults, they could be feeding on kernels at randomly, and you have no idea whether an ear has been damaged or not. And that's where it can be very damaging. You could have a grower who thinks he's got pretty clean ears because they don't have a worm in the tip of it, and yet a consumer buys that ear, drops it in some boiling water, and those damaged kernels can appear as black and darkened areas. And that's not something that most of the consumers want to see.
Entomologist Tom Kuhar and Tracy Leske are our guests. The brown marmorated stink bug is our focus. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. If you want to join the conversation, we've got a phone line open for you at 888-WMRA Talk. Next, let's go to Stanton. Laura, thanks for joining us. Your question or comment for our guests, please.
Hi. Actually, I just wanted to comment on ways to get rid of stink bugs. You can actually eat them.
Okay, you're going to have to tell us more about this, Laura.
Well, I'm actually a newspaper reporter here in Stanton, Virginia, and I've been covering stink bugs for about 2.5 years. And I was up in Northern Virginia, and a chef cooked them all up for a principal to eat in front of his school. And he just fried them up. They taste just like cilantro. So I'm not kidding.
So you had some?
Yes, I did.
So have you since that experience gone out with a net and tried to catch some and cook them at home?
I thought about getting some while I was back home with my parents, since they have tons at their house. But I haven't found a lot here where I live. But, I mean, I might just hide them in food and have people come over and they won't know.
So were they served alone or were they in a taco shell? How did you consume them? I'm curious.
They put them in tacos.
That's what I thought. I think I'd read about that as well. Yeah.
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 No, they're probably providing their own hot sauce.
Exactly.
So this could be America's answer to escargot. Laura, thank you so much for sharing that with us.
Thank you.
You listening can also post to us on our Virginia Insight Facebook page, if you'd like. On Facebook, we're listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. And that's what Carolyn chose to do. She has this question. Can you tell me about the bug's life cycle? When they mate, lay eggs, etc. I'm killing them one by one when they show up in my house, but is that too late? Have they already laid their eggs? Tracy?
No, actually, the bugs that are in our homes right now are kind of like non-paying tenants. They came in last fall as the adult stage, and they went into what we call diapause, which is essentially a form of hibernation. So they are not reproducing in your home. What they're doing right now is trying to escape your home, where they will mate, feed on plants, and start reproducing. So everyone that you kill right now is going to be a bug that no longer reproduces outdoors, which is a good thing. And so they'll spend, you know, May, June, July, August, and even into September completing their development. And in the Mid-Atlantic, where we are, we have seen 1 to 2 generations per year. And what that means is that they complete a life cycle from egg to adult, 2 times in up to. And it takes.
Is there a particular like mating season or birthing season or?
Well, it's starting right now. And in fact, in the next couple of weeks, we as scientists will be out looking for egg masses, which is the first sign that they've become reproductively active. So in other words, the bugs, the adults will be laying eggs on the undersides of leaves in nature. And so that will begin by mid-May and basically continue on until they'll continue to lay eggs until somewhere in mid-August or so.
So if Carolyn kills the ones that she finds in her house, she's doing a service because she's keeping them from reproducing.
Exactly. So any bug, you know, she's just taken out, you know, and considering each female can lay on average around 200 eggs during her lifetime. So you could do the math.
So those of us who are trying to be particularly gentle and we think we're being eco-friendly or at least not causing the smell to erupt in our household by killing them there and we just pick them up and take them outside, that's not such a good idea.
Well, I don't know what impact it will have on a macro scale, but certainly, you know, I think at least from what I hear from many of our growers, they find it very satisfying to, you know, annihilate those that they find in their homes.
We also have this on Facebook from Sarah. Sarah says, a friend was telling me the other day that she found stink bugs inside Tupperware containers in her cupboard. She swears that those containers had been sealed shut, and she does not know how they got in. Is this possible, Tom Kuhar?
I think her husband's playing a joke on her, possibly. No, I don't. I've never heard of a stink bug moving inside a sealed Tupperware container. However, they clearly like to find sheltered areas where they can hide as best they can and get into a small crevice. So it's certainly possible they were in the cabinet, and if that lid was not completely airtight, that might have been a very nice place for them to. I have seen them in containers in people's garages. You know, so they like, you know, say a coffee can that had some items in it in someone's garage. That seems to be a nice place to find the bug. So it's
and
possible.
They just need the slightest of opening, Tracy. There's a word that I've heard you use before that starts with a T, and I can't begin to pronounce it.
Well, it's this behavior known as, well, they are thigmotactic, where they
thigmotactic.
They like to be touching, you know, different surfaces between layers of stuff. So like Tom was saying, it doesn't take much space for them to start to tuck in. You know, we've seen them in very tight quarters.
And you both are doing research on interesting ways to try to decrease their population. In other words, solution for the stink bug problem. We're going to talk some about that. Tom Kuhar, there's something about soapy water and a bright light that you've been working with?
Well, yes. My graduate student, John Agner, has actually taken on this small project.
Okay, well, hold on to that. Sure. We're going to go to a break here, but we'll hear the rest of that story in just a bit more than 1 minute. We would like to send out best wishes to the entomologist who is usually based at Virginia Tech's Agricultural Research Center in Winchester, Virginia. Chris Berg had planned to be with us today, but at the last minute, Dr. Berg was called away on a family matter. We do have with us U.S. Department of Agriculture entomologist Tracy Leske, plus from the main Virginia Tech campus in Blacksburg, entomologist Tom Kuhar. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Light and water and soap, Tom Kuhar.
That's correct, Tom. One thing researchers noticed a couple years ago with this new invasive stink bug was that it is drawn to lights at night, and didn't take long to notice that, where the bugs had built up huge populations. You could find tons of them aggregated around lights, particularly late in the summer. So one thing that homeowners have found, and this has been your homeowners coming up with some of these ideas, not just scientists, and basically that is to use that light against the bug in a way to trap them out of your house. And there's been some various designs on the internet. You can find, you know, there's at least 10 different homemade models of stink bug light traps. And I have a graduate student, John Agner, who one of his objectives, in addition to doing research on agricultural crops, was to just see which one of these light traps seems to be working the best, because that seemed to be the question that everyone wanted to know, and how to get them out of our houses. And basically, a simple water pan with soapy water. And
this is like a turkey roasting pan or something?
Turkey roasting pan, one of those aluminum foil pans, seemed to work great. Basically, some pan with a reflective surface beneath it. It could be a mirror, it could be aluminum foil, and a light shining down on it. And the water should be soapy water with some dish soap in there, because that'll help drown the bugs. And basically, one of those traps we have found in Northern Virginia. One of the designs came from a homeowner in Loudoun County, Ann Larson. And basically, she showed me this 2 years ago, and she was catching over 100 bugs a night. My student has been testing the different traps, and this winter we've gotten the same results. And basically, that turkey roasting pan with a light shining above it. In this case, we used a desk lamp that was anchored down so that it couldn't fall into the pan of water. Or you can have a light coming from the ceiling shining down, maybe a flashlight. But that trap outperforms the other by far, and catches a lot of bugs, and that device seems to work very well.
Hey, Tom, are they putting those in any particular room when they're catching those stink bugs, or any particular location in the house?
Yeah, that's a great question, Tracy. Basically, this experiment was, what was neat about it is it used citizen science. And really, that was the only way that this could be done. My student John and I had discussed, how are we going to design an experiment to test how well you can trap bugs out of a house? Do we build a somewhat of a house structure and try to simulate that and keep all the conditions controlled and replicate it? And I said, well, John, we're not going to build 50 houses in order to do this experiment. So, and it basically works. How we have it is a homeowner would put one trap in one room, and every couple of days you rotate your traps. So you may have one in the living room, you may have one in a bedroom, you may have one in another room. And those traps just keep rotating randomly. And so basically the location of it varies. And, you know, we're trying to have each trap get in each room, you know, under a representative basis so that each trap is tested equally.
But you use these traps indoors.
Right.
So far they've not been found efficacious outside near a garden.
Well, I will take that back. There's research that's undergoing, and there's actually some commercially available large-scale light traps that these bugs will go to lights outside as well. It's just the whole goal and purpose of that. If you're trying to trap a couple hundred of them out of a house, well, a light trap seems to have a possibility. If you're trying to get rid of a million of them in an orchard, well, you know, that could be a bigger challenge. The size of the light you would need, the number of traps that you would need.
Yeah, I'll just follow up on that too, Tom, with the behavior of the bug. It's interesting because, you know, in a house, you're dealing with a sort of a low intensity light source with some of the light sources that I know Tom and John are using in their experiment. But some of these big orchard lights are very intense, bright lights. And so through some of the behavioral work that we've been doing with the bug will approach the light. It orients, it detects the light. It's positively phototactic. That's what we call that when it moves toward the light. However, when it's really bright, it arrests them short of that light. So they'll stop. So in other words, when we see even outdoors, you know, people will see these large aggregations around these bright dusted on lights, but they won't actually touch the light source itself. And so you have to think about how to utilize that behavioral response, you know, to light. Are they aggregating around it? Are they attracted directly to that light source? And so then you get into whether you're trying to trap them out, as Tom said, or maybe you're just trying to monitor their activity. This is what, you know, some of the goals are in agriculture as well.
And when you're particularly trying to destroy this stink bug, the brown marmorated stink bug, that is this invasive species from Asia, I would imagine that you're looking for techniques that will center on this critter and not harm beneficial insects or harm birds or,
sure,
or other outdoor creatures, other than the water trap. We got some other stuff you're working on?
We do. One of the other areas that we've been doing a lot of work on is to identify the pheromone of this stink bug, because many insects produce pheromones that they use to either attract each other, find each other in nature. And so in the case of stink bugs, typically the males produce a pheromone, and it's actually attractive to both males and females and nymphs. And so the last several years, we've been working with our colleagues in Beltsville, Maryland, Ashot Krimian and Aijin Zhang and others, along with Tom and a team across the country to identify this compound. And so the last several years, we've made a lot of progress where we now have this pheromone. It's very specific. It attracts brown marmorated stink bugs to traps, but not necessarily a lot of other non-targets. And that's exactly what you were mentioning, that we want something very specific. So now, you know, in the future, now that we have these attractive compounds, these lures or baits that we can attract and aggregate them, we can think about designing things like attract and kill strategies to, you know, help reduce the numbers, at least on a local scale, on a farmscape scale.
And I'm not sure this is relevant to what most everybody wants to know, which is how do you get rid of these things? But I can't help asking, is there any speculation on why this pheromone that's released by the male attracts not only adult females, but also other adult males?
So, it, you know, typically it could be the kind of evolutionary relationship where over time, you know, the male originally, you know, was producing this compound, and somewhere along the line, just for females, but somewhere along the line, another male was like, hey, that's where the females are going. I can detect it too. I'm going over there, you know? But really it could be a cue that actually indicates good resources, like food-based resources. And also maybe, you know, like I said, the party's over there. Everybody head over there.
Well, you may have a stink bug experience that you think was fairly special and unique. We'd love to hear about it. You may have had some luck getting rid of them, or you may have a question about how to deal with them. If any of those apply to you, we've got some phone lines open at 888-WMRA-TALK, 888-967-2825. Entomologists Tom Kuhar and Tracy Leskey are our guests. Next, we're going to Charlottesville. Linda, thanks for joining us. Your question or comment, please.
Hi, Tom. Yes, I heard somewhere, and it may be just a rumor, that there was some type of wasp they were thinking about introducing that was a natural enemy to the stink bug and would attack their eggs.
You may have heard that here, because we've actually talked about that a few times. Tom Kuhar, last time you were with us, you were telling us some about this. Tell us some more.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Linda. The bug originated in Asia, and researchers from the USDA have gone over to China and have searched for natural enemies of that stink bug. And one of the key players of keeping populations in check in Asia are these egg parasitoids, and there's certain species that are somewhat specific to this bug. this bug species, and they have brought some of those species over, and they are currently in quarantine in Newark, Delaware, in the USDA lab. And before you make any releases in this country, you have to do tests to make sure there's no non-target organisms that are going to be damaged by this parasitoid. So currently, that research is undergoing. They are screening these parasitoids to see if they attack other stink bugs, including predatory ones, which we would consider to be beneficial. So they haven't made those releases yet of these Asian parasitoids, but they have brought them over. They have rather large colonies, enough to do research on, and so that they are moving along with that. So the ultimate goal is to actually reunite this parasitoid with its pest here, this brown marmorated stink bug, and that is the goal. Now, at the same time, there's research going on studying the native egg parasitoids that we have of our stink bugs that we currently have had in this country for centuries, and there are certain species of parasitoids that will attack certain stink bugs, but they may switch hosts when, you know, it could be that they realize now that, well, hey, we can develop on this brown marmorated. I didn't recognize it at first, but, hey, it's a pretty good egg mass. And you may have selection for parasitoids that we already have here that may start attacking our brown marmorated. And there is research going on across the country where we are studying whether that some of those changes may be taking place.
Dr. Tracy Leske from the USDA, Tom Kuhar's colleague from Virginia Tech, Chris Berg, I've heard him say before that he wants people to know that the kind of wasp that Tom was just talking about is really tiny and it's not a stinging wasp. Remember that correctly?
You did. That's correct. This wasp is about the size of a comma on a printed piece of paper, so it's very tiny. It is non-stinging, and what this wasp does is it literally deposits its egg into the eggs of brown marmorated stink bug. And so when its egg hatches, it literally consumes the embryo of the brown marmorated stink bug. And so these parasitoids that Tom mentioned in Asia, some of the studies that have been done indicate that they can wipe out up to 80% of the egg masses that are out there. So you can imagine if we were able to wipe out 80% of the egg masses that are contributing to our populations here in the U.S., that would really decrease, you know, the populations that all of us are dealing with. But again, as Tom mentioned earlier, it's a very specific screening process that must be undertaken before these wasps would be permitted for release. They're still undergoing this host specificity screening that Tom was describing.
Any idea how much longer it needs to go on before a decision is made about whether it can be released?
Well, you know, right now, the researchers at Newark, Delaware, as well as Oregon, Michigan, Florida, they're basically bringing in all of our native stink bug species and screening them. So it as much time as it takes to be able to collect those data, because they are going to be, you know, it's got to be a very complete and rigorous data set in order for a decision to be made. So they're estimating maybe another 12 to 18 months of research, and then those data will be put into a permit that will be submitted to the regulatory agencies.
From the USDA's Agricultural Research Service Center in Kearneysville, West Virginia, research entomologist Tracy Leske is one of our guests. Also with us from the Entomology Department at Virginia Tech, Tom Kuhar. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham, and our phone number is 888-WMRA-TALK, and all numbers, that's 888-967-2825. Next to Stanton, Shelley, thanks for calling. Oh, Shelley, hold on just a second. Linda, thank you so much for that terrific question. Okay, now to Shelley in Stanton.
Hi. I was wondering, I only see the normal-sized stink bugs whenever they come out. I was wondering, how long is their life cycle, and what does an immature stink bug look like, and where do they put their eggs if we can go and get them and scrape eggs somewhere and get them out of the house?
So I'll start, and I'm sure Tom can add more to this. The stink bugs will be laying their eggs on host plants outside your home, so they won't be laying eggs in your home, but on the undersides of leaves. And some of the places that we typically find them in the early spring might be on something like, we see them in our peach orchards on the undersides of peach leaves. There can be other wild hosts that Tom can certainly talk about in the early season. But once those eggs are laid, they're white in color. They are found in masses of 28 usually. So if you count them, typically they'll have 28 eggs. And after they hatch, the immature stages are small, dark insects. They have 6 legs just like the adult, but no wings yet. And the first instar nymphs, the first juvenile stage, will kind of remain on the eggs. And then as they molt to the successive instars, they'll start moving around the plant. But they will have white banding on their legs that you'll see in some of the later instars. Tom, maybe you can add more to that, the description of the nymphs and the life cycle.
Sure. Well, one of the things, Shelley, you will find those the little tiny first instars huddled on that egg mass in which they emerge, and those will have sometimes maybe even black with reddish or orangish marks on them. So little tiny small nymphs, and as they mature, there are black stages of the bug with these white bands on the legs, white bands on the antenna. They just keep getting progressively larger, a grayish in color, until eventually they end up looking like that adult brown marmoted stink bug that you see in your house. And that's as large as they're going to get. That's the adult stage.
Is it possible to see the eggs on a plant in your garden, for example? And if you see them, is there something you can do to decrease the likelihood of them living much longer?
Absolutely. You can. One thing that we've noticed is Tracy and I both have been researching this, and this is when the first egg mass appears out in the wild each year. And I think she and I would both agree that you're not going to find a brown marmoted stink bug egg mass before mid-May. That seems to be there's a light dark phase trigger that, you know, initiates when these bugs will actually start laying their first eggs. So sometime from mid-May on, you can find egg masses throughout the summer, throughout the spring. The females can live a long time and lay eggs throughout their lifespan, and then you have a new generation of adults that are going to overlap with those. So you can find egg masses all season long. There's probably a peak period of finding them in the month of June. And the undersides of tree leaves are probably one of the best locations we've found. Tracy mentioned peach leaves are a good site. There's some wild trees such as Polonia, Catalpa. Some folks have that as an ornamental tree in their yards.
So entomologist Tom Kuhar, if somebody finds them on a plant in their garden or finds them on trees in their yard, or a farmer finds the eggs on leaves in his orchard, are there things that they can do to kill them off at that stage?
Well, you could certainly get rid of the egg mass in one way or another. You can smash it if you want, but you know, one of the problems is that there are a lot of different stink bugs out there. Some are predatory, and it is possible that you could smash the wrong egg mass if you're not you know, sure of what you have. I use it as an educational device for my kids. If we ever find something like that, we pull it off and we keep it on that leaf and put it into some kind of container. And then you watch and you see what comes out. And I think it would be a neat way of saying, wow, look, this is the brown marmoted stink bug. As you can see what these nymphs look like, you can go on the internet and look and see whether this is the right species. So I would say use it as an educational tool. Pull it off that tree. Keep it on the leaf until it hatches.
We'll be back from the break in just about a minute. Shelley, thanks for your call. We have with us U.S. Department of Agriculture entomologist Tracy Leskey, plus from the Maine Virginia Tech campus in Blacksburg, entomologist Tom Kuhar. Our phone number, 888-WMRA-TALK. Tom and or Tracy, we probably ought to know a little bit more about where these bugs are. I mean, all of us have seen them in their homes and our cars. But in the U.S., they started on the East Coast. They were first sighted
right
in Pennsylvania?
That is correct. So the first official record of them being in the U.S. was in Allentown, Pennsylvania. And then in 2002, they were officially found in New Jersey, although they had been there probably a year or two prior to that.
The suspicion is that they probably first came on a cargo ship that ended up
exactly
in New Jersey.
Or some, you know, from port on a trucking. Yeah, exactly. So from there, you know, the next detection was Maryland in 2003, West Virginia in 2004, and I believe Virginia's record was 2005. Here we are in 2013, and there are 40 states across the country that have official detections in them. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that the populations are well established, but it means that somebody has at least reported a specimen. It's been identified and it's been recorded at, you know, at an official level at that state. The most well-established populations right now are here in the Mid-Atlantic, the states that we've been talking about. But more recently, we've had the first reports of crop injury in the states of Ohio, in the Hudson Valley of New York, in North Carolina, in Tennessee, and, you know, on the West Coast, where we have well-established populations in parts of Oregon, places in California, as well as in Washington State. Also, interestingly, they have been found in Ontario. They have moved across the border internationally into Canada, in Hamilton, Ontario. And the other place where there's a well-established population across the world is Switzerland, where they've been found and are established in Zurich, Switzerland as well.
And as they move across the country, I guess the concern is that since they seem to like everything they find,
mm-hmm.
That they're going to threaten more and more different types of crops?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that we did over the last several years was to translate the literature that was available on the stink bug from Asia, from China, Japan, Korea, and look at the host that that bug attacked in those regions to give us a better indication of what it might feed on in the United States. And so one that we in the fruit industry are concerned about potentially as it moves further south is citrus, because in both China as well as South Korea, it's been reported to feed on different types of citrus. And I think probably Tom probably has some others that I think as it moves into other parts of the country, it may attack.
Sure, yeah. One item that we noticed was that we saw a lot of stink bug injury to okra on some vegetable farms, and okra is in the same plant family as cotton. And that made us a little concerned that this could end up being a cotton pest as well. And Virginia was the first state that this bug met cotton in the United States as it moved its way down from Pennsylvania, the first cotton-producing state. And we have noticed bugs in cotton fields, and some research was taken where we took bugs and put them in mesh bags and caged them on developing bowls on cotton plants. This is working with researcher Ames Herbert, Virginia Tech researcher. And basically we found that this bug is very, very damaging to cotton, even more so than the native stink bugs that we've had. One of its attributes is that it can feed on bolls later in their development than our previous stink bugs could. So you've got bolls that could be damaged a lot longer by this stink bug, and you also have a lot more stink bugs. So it can be a cotton pest. We've demonstrated that, and it is now moving into some areas where they have more and more cotton. Now, another thing that we have noticed ecologically is that the bug doesn't like the heat. We have tried to cage bugs on some real hot days in eastern Virginia, and they've all ended up dying. These have been on days that it's been in the high 90s. So, and we've also done some experiments in the lab, and basically if temperatures start to reach 100 degrees Fahrenheit, you're pretty much going to be killing these bugs. So it is not a bug that likes the heat, and that could be something that could maybe make it not as damaging of a pest as it moves further south. But only time will tell, and certainly, you know, we need to keep an eye on this and conduct the research experiments.
Scientists Tracy Leske and Tom Kuhar spend a lot of time around insects, especially the kind that most threaten agriculture. And lately for both of them, that means much focus on the brown marmorated stink bug. Dr. Kuhar is based at the Department of Entomology at Virginia Tech. Dr. Leske is a research entomologist with the United States Department of Agriculture. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. We're going next to Nelson County. Caroline, thank you for joining us. Your question or comment, please.
Well, first of all, I'd like to say I'm disappointed. I was planning to move to Canada to avoid them, and now I find they like cold weather. But over the years, in my own home, I've been massively invaded by stink bugs, and last spring I spent a huge amount of time caulking every single nook and cranny and crevice all around the trim, all around, up inside canister lights, all that kind of thing. And in the fall, I taped all my doors shut, except for one, and it made a huge difference. Instead of catching hundreds a day, it's now down to more like a few dozen. So there is, I mean, you can be vigilant and seal your house really well and keep them out. But the time to act is, you know, in September to really jump on it then.
Yeah, no, Caroline, you're absolutely right. One of the best and first defenses that a homeowner can take is exactly what you've done, which is physical exclusion, trying to find all of those small cracks and crevices where the bugs will enter in the fall. You know, this bug, once it reaches your home, it's going to be looking for those small openings that can provide it with a place to basically hunker down for the winter. And certainly, if those cracks and crevices aren't sealed up, you know, we have a homeowner that works with Tom and I as part of our research, and he literally counted every stink bug in his home back in 2011. And over the course of the winter months, removed over 26,000 from his home. So we know there can be just it can be a horrible problem for homeowners. So I'm really glad to hear you've had success at your home by doing that. You know, because, yeah, the invasion that people deal with, essentially, which occurs between mid-September and mid-October, can be enormously annoying, we'll say.
Caroline, thanks so much for that story of hope. Speaking of hope, Tom Kuhar at Virginia Tech, there was some fear up until maybe a couple of years ago that this bug was not going to be susceptible to insecticides that worked on other bugs. But do I understand that you've now found that at least the insecticide, I think it's called permethrin, is effective?
Well, yeah, Tom. There, I think 2 or 3 years ago, and Tracy can attest to this, there was almost hysteria going on, mainly from some growers who had typically sprayed their crops with their normal agricultural pesticides. You know, they have a program typically, and they follow that, and they keep all their pests off. That program that they typically had used were not getting rid of this new bug, and because of that led to some hysteria that maybe, you know, insecticides aren't killing it, and basically things got blown out of proportion a little bit. But what it was is we needed to do more research and see how susceptible that they were. And basically, I think once the research was all done, and it was done in different labs, was that, yeah, you can kill them with a lot of different insecticides. Permethrin is an example of a pyrethroid insecticide, and there's several in that class of chemistry. It's a widely used.
But the fear about using too much of it is that you end up killing off good insects as well.
Absolutely, and that's the problem. I think the bottom line with all the insecticide work is not that nothing works. It's that what does work is not the best products or the safest products for natural enemies and for non-target organisms. Basically, it's the harsher, broad-spectrum toxins that basically kill a lot of insects. They kill this bug. So what we don't have right now is a more narrow-spectrum targeted chemical that growers can use that can get rid of this bug without eliminating pollinators, without eliminating the predators and parasitoids that keep other insects in check. So that's the problem that we have right now. It's not that there are chemicals that don't work against it. It's just the ones that do, we probably don't want to be spraying on a regular basis.
Dr. Tracy Leske, we have this question from Joseph on our Facebook page that I wanted to toss to you. Joseph says, can these creatures bite you? I've been awakened rather rudely by a sharp sting, and the other night while sitting on the porch at the same home, I experienced the same thing. Could it be a stink bug?
Well, you know, These stink bugs are what we would call vegetarians, so certainly they're not going to suck blood, but they're also probably not the brightest bulbs either. So we've had a number of people report that they've been, I would describe it as probing, where, you know, maybe the bug just accidentally, you know, probes someone, and so it could insert its mouth parts and you know, we'll say, provide a little bit of a jab. You know, we've heard from people that they've had allergic reactions to that, just based on just the you know, the bug being against their skin. So occasionally it does happen, apparently, that the bug will accidentally probe someone, and it may be very irritating to the skin when that happens.
Next to Stanton, Steve, thank you for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment, please.
Yes, thank you. I thought I had a stink bug horror story until one of your guests mentioned that another homeowner had counted over 26,000 stink bugs in his house, but we had a similar experience in the first fall when the stink bug really got bad in our area. We were house-sitting my wife's parents' very fine old house in Stanton, and in the fall, the stink bugs moved in mass, and they had these long drapes that hung over the windows, and the folds of those drapes, once we saw a few stink bugs, we lifted the folds of those drapes back, and there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. So over the course of the fall, we probably had our 20 or 25,000 stink bugs too in the house. And the first wrong thing we did, of course, was try to vacuum them off of the drapes, and that works really well to pack the stink bugs into the vacuum cleaner, and the exhaust on the vacuum cleaner spreads the smell all over the house. So that wasn't a very effective way of dealing with that part of it. But at night, it was like being dive bombed by little airplanes during the night, and so it was.
Yeah, they do sound a lot like wasps when they're flying around your lights at home, don't they?
Yes, they do. And, of course, they're my experience is they're perfectly harmless. I mean, we never had an allergic reaction or a sting. Your guest was talking about the probative nature of them. So we never had anything like that. But, you know, certainly the smell can be pretty noxious. And we ended up throwing one vacuum cleaner away.
Steve, thanks so much for sharing that story. I suspect there are lots of people who can identify. I know I can. A couple of years ago when I was living at what in essence was a farmhouse outside Charlottesville and had been away for a couple of weeks, I came home and I cannot begin to tell you what I found behind the drapes. And I wished back then I had known about Dr. Tom Kuhar's soapy water in a pan with bright light solution, because I sure would have tried it. There are some other things that you are trying. Tracy Leskey, for example, experimenting with the fact that they seem to be attracted to certain kinds of shapes or shadows or things along those lines?
Well, you know, they do. So Tom mentioned it earlier. They are a tree-loving species. So the trap design that we originally have been working with is a trunk-mimicking stimulus. It's just a tall pyramid. And so for a bug that's flying along, it kind of looks like a tree trunk. But, you know, that's not enough. And that's where the pheromone and things like that comes in. And in fact, we've done the same thing with lights. We've actually baited these traps with lights outdoors just to try to identify the wavelengths of light, the colors of light that they respond to. And so, yeah, there are a number of different pieces that you can put together to think about trying to attract and aggregate them to particular locations to help, we'll say, ultimately annihilate larger numbers of them.
And when you attract them to these objects, do you use some sort of insecticide on a strip to kill them, or?
Well, in the collection jar, which sits atop this tall pyramid, we do have a kill strip in there that has an insecticide to knock the bugs down. And the reason for that is this bug is particularly mobile. It can just leave the trap once it enters. They're great flyers. They can actually disperse quite long distances. So you do need something to knock them down. But, you know, ultimately how we do that second part of the, you know, we can attract them and then how we kill them, we still have a lot of ways to go in terms of that.
And Tom Kuhar, in the 30 seconds or so that we have left, I understand that one big concern is for organic farms where there really are not non-insecticide solutions that are viable so far.
Yeah, there is research going on, but right now I think some of the growers that are hardest hit are the organic growers. living in a wooded area where this bug has really taken a stronghold, and there just isn't much that these growers can do about bugs that just keep invading. There are ways of putting screens up and to protect your crops, but there's limitations to doing things like that.
The only thing found effective so far is real fine mesh over crops, but that has limitations too?
Well, yeah, it certainly does. If you need pollination to occur as your crop grows, you can't have that screen restricting growth. So
we're going to have you back in a year or two to find out what your latest research shows.
Sure.
Our guests have been from the Virginia Tech Department of Entomology, Tom Kuhar, and from the USDA's Agricultural Research Service, research entomologist Tracy Leskey. Dr. Leskey, Dr. Kuhar, thank you both so very much for making time for us.
Thank you.
Sure, thank you.
Virginia Insights executive producer Matt Bingay, associate producers Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jospe and Inner Rhythm. You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. And when you get to that page, you will find more information about both of our guests and the work they're doing. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.